This summer, I'm taking a new approach to styling the smallest spaces in my house with help from Bob's Discount Furniture. Bob's has the small space solutions that America's waited 250 years for, like retro chic bedroom sets with plenty of storage, dinner party ready dining sets in four fun colors, stylish spacious Bobopedic sofas, and feature-packed power recliners that let me kick back in even the smallest rooms. Plus, I know that Bob's styles are backed by thousands of real five-star customer reviews, so I can trust that the furniture that I'm getting is not just affordable, but built to last. And the best part? Bob's furniture ships fast, so I can enjoy my new styles all summer long. So when you're ready to ditch the furniture you're not excited about for the latest trends in small space styling, stop in or shop online at Bob's Discount Furniture, where America shops for furniture.
From the smoke over Moscow's refineries to the lopsided bargaining tables of the Middle East, the old rules of deterrence are being quietly rewritten, and the people living under them are being asked to call it normal. Welcome to This Week Explained. I'm Tiana, and as always, I am joined by my co-host, Kervin. And this week, we are following a slow, deliberate campaign to strangle an empire's war machine at the source, the fuel and the supply lines that keep it running, even as Russia's state media works overtime to tell its citizens that everything's fine. But the sharper game is the one playing out in the shadows. We're tracking a controversial new framework that somehow leaves a battered Tehran holding the stronger economic hand, a hidden tripwire wired straight into Lebanon's survival, and a telling pivot from the Kremlin backing away from a bloody military defeat in Africa's Sahel and pouring its energy instead into quiet political warfare in Armenia. So is this a real cooling of a multi-front world, or just authoritarian powers buying time to rewrite the rules in their favor? Let's get into the state of play. We will start, as we always do, in Ukraine. And there is this one detail I just can't get out of my head no matter what. You've got smoke pouring over Moscow, this huge dark column that you can see for miles. And right underneath it, somebody's just sitting by the water, fishing. Kids on the swings across the way, people walking home with their groceries like it's nothing. And that image tells us more than any official statement ever could. Because what we're looking at isn't calm, it's adaptation. People have rebuilt their whole definition of normal around something that should never be considered normal. So, Kervin, I ask you, is it some form of denial, or is it just what survival looks like when you genuinely can't do anything about it?
Yeah, I think it's a little closer to the second one. There's this quote from a woman as she looks up at the smoke and basically says, you know, there's nothing we can do. It's the government's call. All we can do is watch. And that's not denial. That's a population that's been quietly taught this isn't theirs to question.
And that's the part that gets me, because for so long, this was something the Russian population could say was happening somewhere else, somewhere far away. But now it's overhead.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the real shift here. The capital used to be psychologically off limits. It was the one place where the war was an idea, not a fact. That barrier is gone now. And you don't get that back.
So how does the leadership even handle that? Because I think you can't just ignore something the whole city can see with its own eyes.
Yeah, I think that's the fascinating part here. The response from the top leadership wasn't some very public statement. It was silence. Even the messaging through state media, they all landed on the same line. They all basically said, whatever they did to us, we're doing worse to them.
That sounds familiar, that messaging.
Yeah, it's very familiar. You always hear that.
Yeah, well, I mean, the current administration is really big on that sort of thing. So they're like, oh, they did this? We're going to annihilate them. We're going to wipe this entire civilization off the planet. And, you know, wording like that.
Yeah, it's absolutely. And it's all about framing, right? Because you're it's not about what it says to the international community. It's very much a domestic conversation.
Okay, so when every single voice says the exact same thing at the exact same moment, it kind of stops being a coincidence and it starts being a script.
Right, and when you're managing the message that carefully, what you're telling me is you're worried about how it lands at home to a domestic audience again. Confident people don't choreograph reassurance the way that we're seeing Russia do it now.
Okay, so set the messaging aside for 1 second. Underneath all of it, what's actually getting hit that matters? Because I don't think this is really about one building.
No, and I think this is where this podcast is going to differ from your mainstream news media. It's because we're not going to focus on that single target. The focus here is on what's getting squeezed. And what's getting squeezed here is the fuel. So the strikes on the production side and the strikes way down south on the supply routes, they're not two separate stories here.
Right, because Ukraine can blow up the refinery and they can also make sure the already flowing fuel never reaches where it's going.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And on one end, you choke what's actually getting made, right? And that's the refineries. On the other end, you choke the movement. And the human version of that is what's already showing up. You've got lines at gas pumps, rationing, prices climbing. And this is in Russia, might sound familiar to other people. And so when ordinary people are queuing for fuel, the pressure has left the battlefield and it's walked straight into the daily lives of the civilian population.
And honestly, that southern piece feels like a bigger story to me, even though it's getting way less attention than the smoke building over the Capitol.
And I would agree completely on this one. Yeah, the strike in Moscow is the one everybody films. It's what everybody's talking about. But the quiet, methodical work of cutting a peninsula off from its supply roads, that's the one that actually changes what an army can do. You can't launch this big summer push if your tanks are running on fumes.
Okay, so is this the moment that the tide turns? Like, is this the shift that everyone kept waiting for?
I don't think we are there just yet. So there's a real advantage right now for Ukraine, but a lot of the people who study this closely are saying the same thing. This is not the permanent state. The Russian side is going to adapt. They're going to reroute, reinforce, and then the opening there for Ukraine starts to close. So this is less this wins the war and more this is a door that opens right now and might not stay open. Why? Because there are only so many ways onto that southern peninsula.
Okay, but here's what I keep thinking about. All of this is happening, and at the very same time, there's talk of negotiations, of peace terms on the table. So how do those two things live in the same week?
All right, it does sound a little puzzling, doesn't it? That's because the headline says talks, but the substance here says something completely different. The terms that came from Ukraine and the Europeans, that got rejected flat out by Russia. It also had this added move of saying Europe doesn't even get a seat at the negotiating table.
Which is a strange thing to dig in on if you actually want a deal.
Yeah, it certainly would be strange if you wanted a deal. And we both know Putin doesn't really want a deal here unless that deal is unconditional surrender from the Ukrainians. So he's stalling. His demands haven't moved even an inch here, and it's still the same maximal ask that it's always been.
So the talk is part of the fight. It's not separate from it at all.
Yeah, that's the whole thing there. It's fight and talk. And the talking does have a job here. Pull the bigger powers apart from each other. It's all the European powers pulling away from Ukraine. And if you can get one major capital leaning toward a deal while the others hold firm, you split the coalition without firing a shot.
And then the strikes on the capital almost become convenient, like a reason you can point to after the fact.
Yeah, you caught the sleight of hand from the Russian side, exactly. The escalation was already building well before the attack ever happened, but now there's a clean story for it. Look what they did. We have no choice. We have to respond to that. The cause and the excuse aren't the same thing, and it's worth keeping those two apart in your head.
Right, and the whole Ukraine conversation, the shooting slowing down while the real fight quietly moves to the table, that's almost the exact shape of the other story we come back to every single week, the Iran one.
Yeah, and this week we finally got a document out of this. Both sides actually put the framework out in writing, in public. And honestly, that's the first thing I would flag before anything else here.
Right, because normally that's where these things fall apart, isn't it? One side says one thing and the other side says the exact opposite.
Exactly. Usually each side sprints to the cameras with a totally different version of what got agreed to, just to box the other guy in. And this time they're describing the same deal. That tells you the actual negotiators on all sides actually want the fighting to stop, at least for now.
Okay, so that's the good news. But I've read enough of these by now to know you are about to tell me the deal itself is a disaster.
I mean, yeah, people may not want to hear this, or maybe they're going to disagree with what I'm about to say, but this deal is fairly lopsided. It's pretty dramatically lopsided. One side walks out with most of what it wanted, and it gets it up front before the real negotiation even happens.
Well, that explains why they were saying there were the same things in the agreement. They're excited that they're getting everything that they want, while the other side capitulates to everything. And obviously, by one side, you mean Tehran.
Exactly. The money starts moving. The oil starts flowing again. The pressure comes off their ports. All of that is basically immediate. That is happening right now as we speak. The stuff the other side actually cares about, the U.S. side here, the Israeli side, that all got pushed down the road.
Hold on, though. Walk me through why that's such a big deal. Because to a normal person, they got their stuff first. Sounds like a detail, not a problem.
Right. Remember last week we discussed how these negotiations derail because both sides are waiting for their side to get their stuff first. Now, with all of the U.S. wins here that are promised for later, Iran really has zero reason to hurry right now. They can sit at the table as long as they feel like it, and then they reap the benefits of that oil flow. The people who thought they were holding all the leverage are now the ones who need to have this deal, this overarching peace deal, finalized in the next 60 days. And the side that literally got blown into the Stone Age is the one who can just shrug, say, yeah, we're just going to walk out and rebuild.
It feels backwards because by every measure, Tehran did not have a good war.
No, they didn't. They got hammered. I don't want to gloss over that. They lost people at the very top of the IRGC and within their government. They lost the thing that made everyone nervous about them in the first place. And now there's somebody brand new in charge that nobody really has a read on.
So this is the part that I keep coming back to. How do you lose a war that badly and still walk out of the room with a better hand?
I think it's because they played the only cards they had left. They couldn't win on the ground, so they made the economics painful enough for everybody else that the fastest exit was just to give them what they wanted.
And, quote, everybody else, end quote, includes a whole lot of people who were never even in the fight.
I think that's the point that a lot of people miss here. The pain from squeezing the Strait of Hormuz isn't an Iran problem or even a U.S. problem. It's a price at the pump problem. It's a price at the pump problem everywhere. So there's enormous pressure to just make it stop, whatever it costs.
Okay, I want to get to the part that's actually happening while we're sitting here recording, because there's a third player in all of this who never signed a thing.
Yeah, I think that's the crack that's running straight through the middle of all of this. The agreement quietly assumes one of the closest partners in the region is actually on board. The agreement is written in as, I'll quote it here, quote, and their allies, end quote. But that partner didn't sign the agreement and doesn't necessarily want the same ending at all.
Right, because their goal was never just to stop the fighting. Their goal was more like, make sure the other side can never come at us again.
Exactly, and those two goals don't live in the same sentence. One party wants it over. One party wants to survive and call it a win. And the third, Israel, wants the other side permanently broken.
And here's what really got my attention. The fighting in Lebanon, that's actually named in this deal. It's written in explicitly.
Yeah, it is. And I think that's the trap here, honestly. They put a promise about Lebanon's safety right at the very front of the agreement. And the two sides, the U.S. and Iran, made keeping that promise a condition for the rest of the talks to even keep going.
So let me make sure I've got this straight. if the strikes in Lebanon keep happening, then the whole thing technically loses its footing. That basically hands Tehran a gift, doesn't it? They don't even have to be the ones to break it.
Yeah, and that's the move here. So Iran can lean back, point at what's happening in Lebanon and say, well, look, the conditions aren't being met here. And they keep everything they already banked while they say that. And that's a clean exit. It's a clean exit if they decide they want one.
So the real question, and this is the one I honestly can't answer, is whether they want an exit or whether they want to stay and squeeze for more.
Yeah, and that's exactly where I'd lay out these two competing reads. So one, the strikes are meant to blow the whole thing up. Two, the strikes are just pressure, a way to pry out better terms without actually flipping the table.
And how do you even tell those two apart? Because from the outside, they look identical.
Yeah, you watch for the timing. So if Hezbollah strikes Israel every time there's an attempt to cool things down, that leans toward you're trying to break this deal. Now, if they go quiet whenever the talks hit a delicate moment, that's squeezing the negotiations. And the next stretch of days are going to pretty much tell us which one is being chosen.
All right, let me push on one more thing, because I know people are thinking it. There's this giant pot of reconstruction money that's buried in here. That's the headline a lot of folks, you know, kind of grabbed onto. And yeah, maybe that's the softest thing in the entire document. It's not a check. It's a promise to maybe someday write a check with partners who haven't actually agreed to pay anything. So it might just not exist.
Yeah, it might just be a number on a page. And here's the uncomfortable part. Even if the money does show up, the people best positioned to grab it are the same security guys who already run half the economy over there, not the people of Iran. So reconstruction here can quietly turn into something else entirely.
And the nuclear side of it, because that was supposed to be the whole reason for any of this. That was the red line.
Yeah, it's softer than it sounds, too. The arrangement basically lets them handle the material in their own house on their own terms, deciding who's allowed in to be the watchdogs here. And anybody who's followed those inspection fights over the years knows exactly how that tends to go.
So basically, every hard thing got shoved into the next round.
Yeah, every single hard conversation. What stops right now is the fighting and the blockade, which... genuinely, that is good. This is good for everyone. Real people stop dying. But the actual disagreements, the ones that started all of this, those are still sitting there untouched, waiting.
And the clock to solve them is very short.
Yeah, short with a built-in trapdoor, too. They literally wrote in that it can be extended if both sides feel like it should be extended. That's the drafters telling you very quietly, we don't actually think we're going to finish in time.
All right. Well, every week it feels like our conversations come back to the same thing. Outside powers reaching into places that aren't theirs. And this week is no exception. But the angle flips. Because this is a power that reached in years ago. And right now its grip is coming loose.
Yeah, I think we're going to get to hear a story that almost nobody's giving the weight it deserves. We're talking down in the Sahel. That band of countries across the middle of Africa, Russia's whole pitch there has been, we're the security partner who actually shows up, and that pitch is cracking.
Okay, so remind people how Russia even got that foothold.
So over the last few years, you had this run of coups, Mali, Burkina Faso, Niger. The new governments there threw out the French. They walked away from the old regional blocs and said they'd take the Russians instead. This first Wagner, then that got rebranded as Russia's Africa Corps. The deal was simple: we'll keep you in power if you give us access.
And let me guess, the deal's not holding.
Who could have predicted that? Who?
Who years ago said this was going to happen? Who said that?
We'll have to do some research on that and tell you next week.
You just got to go back a couple years. in this podcast, and you'll hear him saying, "This is a bad idea, guys. Don't do it."
Yeah.
Well, you know, sorry. But this was something they had to find out on their own, you know?
Well, in that, that's true. No one, you know, no one in power is listening to us talk. So, there's that too. Might be a better world if you did, but, yeah, you're absolutely right. It's not holding. And the big tell here is up in northern Mali, where a city the government had only just clawed back with Russian muscle, mind you, fell out of their hands again. And then the Russian side pulled back, ran away, rather than dig in and hold it.
Because they were like, this doesn't affect us, really. You guys can figure it out. I mean, we already tried to help. Okay, so wait, walk me through why this lands so hard. A city changing hands, that happens in a war.
Right, but it's not the city, it's the signal. If you're one of these juntas and you bet your whole survival on the guys who promised they'd protect you, and then those guys negotiate their way out the moment it gets ugly, your whole reason for hiring them just evaporated in real time. The product was, we don't leave, and they left.
And the people watching all of this, they aren't only in Mali.
No, the neighbors are also recalculating. You've even got Benin, they're sitting right there on the coast, making moves to warm up to these same juntas, basically trying to get ahead of the instability instead of waiting for it to spill over the border.
So is this Russia losing Africa? Because that feels like a really big swing.
Yeah, I will be a little careful here. I'm not going to say Russia is losing, not yet. I'd say the brand's taken a big hit here. There's a difference between getting kicked out and getting exposed as less reliable than advertised. And right now it's Russia getting exposed as less reliable than advertised.
So what makes it worse for them, though, is the threat on the other side isn't slowing down at all.
Yeah, not even a little. The insurgent side's getting way more sophisticated. You're seeing groups that used to want to have nothing to do with each other actually lining up. Jihadist outfits and separatist fighters pointed at the same governments. So the demand for protection is climbing at the exact moment the supplier starts looking shaky.
And that gap, strong demand, shaky supplier, that's usually where somebody else steps in.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the question hanging over the whole region here. If the Russian guarantee keeps looking thin, who moves into that space? Because a security vacuum doesn't tend to stay empty for very long.
Okay, but here's what I want to connect, because I don't think these are two separate stories. If the boots on the ground version of Russian power is struggling in Africa, there's this other version of how they operate showing up at the same time, and it's a lot quieter.
Yeah, and it's the part I find genuinely interesting. There are basically two ways to project power. One is the hard way, soldiers, mercenaries, holding ground, and the other is soft power, sneaky. You don't send troops, you send money and influence into somebody's election.
And that is what is reportedly happening in Armenia.
Yeah, reportedly. And I do want to flag it as reporting. There's a plan being floated to put a thumb on the scale of Armenia's vote. Tip the politics instead of winning a battle. When you look at where Russia's actually strong right now, that tracks.
But why Armenia, though? Like, help me understand why that might be the pivot from the Africa story. That makes no sense to me. I can't find the connection.
Right. So Armenia sits in Russia's old backyard, and that relationship's gone pretty frosty the last couple of years. Armenia's been drifting, looking west into Western Europe, feeling let down by Moscow. Now, for Moscow's chair, you can't exactly send an army to fix that. This isn't the Sahel. This isn't even Ukraine, but an election. An election you can try to shape from the shadows.
So put the two halves together for me. What's the bigger picture when you line up Africa and Armenia?
Yeah, I think the picture here is a power that is adapting. So when the expensive boots heavy model gets exposed, the way it's getting exposed in the Sahel, you lean harder on the cheap, deniable one. An influence operation cost a fraction of a mercenary deployment, and nobody can pin it on you cleanly.
Which is almost more unsettling, oddly enough.
It is, because it's so much harder to see and so much harder to counter. This is how it started in the Sahel, right? Like Russia's information operations, getting France out, getting U.S. influence out. A column of fighters shows up on satellite. A quiet transfer into a campaign does not. So the same week the hard power looks weaker, the soft power looks like it just got a bigger budget.
And that makes me wonder where else that same playbook is already running, somewhere we just haven't clocked yet. Because that's the thread through all of this. The front lines aren't fixed anymore. A civilian line at a fuel pump, a quiet payment into someone's campaign, small things, and they can reset the options of an entire army. And the stakes are anything but settled. If Tehran banks its economic relief now and keeps kicking the hard defense concessions down the road, the balance in the Middle East tilts, and it doesn't tilt back easily. If that fragile arrangement in Lebanon cracks, or if Russia's crumbling security brand in Mali hands the Sahel to an insurgent alliance that's suddenly fighting as one, the pauses we're watching this week don't hold. They evaporate. These windows of advantage are short, and the clock on every one of them is running down. We'll be right here every week, watching where the sand shifts next. But before we sign off, is there anything you want to get into?
Nope, that is all I have for this week. How about yourself?
I think we should start a countdown.
Okay. Countdown to?
Us being together again. We are in. Okay. We are in the final stretch here. We are finally, you guys have listened to our not so great audio for the last year.
All the pauses for the next person to say something.
Yeah, all the pauses. Nobody talks over. Because we bought, I don't know what it's called, because Kirvin's in charge of all of that. But the thing that, you know, smooths out our audio and makes it to where we can talk over each other if we want to. Yeah, we'll go back to the tangents, because we did see your comment, Dana. One of our listeners, Dana, commented and said that they miss the tangents that we used to go on. And we can't really do that on here because, you know, we can't talk over each other. And a lot of times, by the time Kirvin's done talking, I forgot what I wanted to talk about anyways.
And it's easier to interrupt the other person when you're looking them in the face.
Yeah.
It feels being like, I have something to say right now.
Yeah. So we have, hold on, let me see. About 2 months.
Yep. Right around 2 months.
2.5 months or whatever. So, huh. Let me pull up my calendar so you guys can count down with us.
Mark your calendars, folks.
What'd you say? What?
I said, mark your calendars, folks.
Oh, mark your calendars, folks. Okay. 10 weeks. Well, I guess, 10 weeks. Wait, no, I skipped over a whole month. Wait, no, I didn't. Oh my gosh, I'm losing my mind.
No, 10 weeks sounds right.
Yeah, it's 10. It's 10 weeks. We did it, Joe. I'm just so excited.
Me too.
It's going to be awesome. It's going to be awesome. Yeah. So anyways, 10 weeks, guys, and then you'll notice a very clear difference in our audio. Surprise.
We won't say anything, but you'll know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we just said 10 weeks, and all these people have access to calendars if they have access to the internet to get the podcast.
Well, I just mean, like, you'll probably know because we'll miss 2 weeks.
Yeah, that's true, because we'll be settling in.
Yeah.
So excited.
And not driving down the street to move, that's for sure.
Yeah, that part. yeah, that part's a little stressful. I mean, I'm packing this entire house by myself, which,
don't feel
bad for me. I'm really good at it. I've done it every single move. Like, I'm really good at it.
Those boxes are stacking up. You're Tetrising everything.
I am Tetrising and, figuring out what's going to stay here and then figuring out what we want to bring. And Charlotte has already informed me that every single bit of her Madoka Magica merch is coming with us. She's like, that is a non-negotiable. Lord. And I was like, crap, that's a lot.
I'll have to talk to the authorities.
No, you better let her bring that stuff in or she's staying here. And I don't want that to happen. But yeah, I just remember like whenever you moved last year, last May, just it felt so long, like the goalpost was so far away. And now that we're almost there, I feel like I procrastinated too much. Like I just kept kicking the can down the road, a lot like the agreement between the U.S. and Iran currently.
And she just brings it back.
I brought it back to the subject. Look at me.
Well, you'll be hitting here at a good time, because if you were here today, you'd be sweating like I am.
Ugh. That's not okay. I am going to buy like air conditioner thing, like portable air conditioner things or something.
So are the people here. Screw this.
This girl is entering perimenopause and I can't be having that. Well, luckily.
Well, you'll be able to burp the house every day.
I do like that part. I do like the house burping thing. That sounds great. Getting fresh air from outside and letting the stale air out. I love that part. I'm excited. It's going to be fine. And I've been in Europe in the summer and during a heat wave. And whenever we took that stupid bus.
Laying under a bed. Charlotte does.
Oh, yeah. Well, where was that? Was that Belgium?
That was Belgium.
We had like a two-story hotel room that was like a loft, which we were on the top floor. So, you know, hot air rises and they don't have AC everywhere. It's not standard. And Charlotte slept under the bed on the floor. She refused to sleep in the bed. She was like, I don't want anything that could trap heat touching me. She didn't want sheets on her. Yeah. So she'll be sleeping.
Hotel room was a cool concept, though.
Huh?
The hotel room was a cool concept.
Yeah, I'm sure it's fabulous every other time of year except summer. Like every other, in fact, in the winter, it's probably, since hot air rises, it's probably preferable. Yeah. I don't know how cold it gets in Belgium for winter or anything. But anyways, like I was saying, when we were on that train, that underground train, and what was supposed to take us 2 hours, I think, it took like 12 hours because it was so hot that it melted like AC units and it melted things on the tracks and it was horrible. You remember that, right?
Oh, absolutely. I remember every moment of you trapped in the tunnel.
It's called the tunnel?
Yeah.
Oh, look at you with your Europe speak.
I'm global, baby.
Yeah. Well, I see that or hear that. But yeah, that was, I mean, we didn't complain. I have to say, whenever things, because we've had a couple travel mishaps in England and they extended our travel times by a lot, and we never complain. We just be like, we can't do anything about this, so we'll just park it.
Yeah. Sometimes it's my own doing of not remembering when our flight is.
I was referring to whenever that person got hit by the train, and we had to get off the train and wait for buses at the train station in England.
In the rain.
And, you know, we had my dad who was partially disabled at that point. He could walk, but not very far. And so he was so chill the entire time. And if you know my dad, he's not chill. He was not chill.
And I just remember getting on the train and the guy looking at our ticket and go, oh, you got a good ticket. Like, yeah. This train goes straight to where you want to go, and it's not going to make too many stops.
Mm-hmm.
And like 5 minutes later, they're like, everybody off the train.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, So Dana, was that a good enough tangent for you? Let us know. Let us know if that was okay. Do you have anything else you want to talk about? Because we have jibber-jabbered. Good. Yeah, we jibber-jabbered sufficiently. Nothing else?
No, nothing else. I thought that was perfect.
All right. Well, thank you so much for listening to This Week Explained. We hope that you found it both informative and engaging. If you have any feedback or suggestions for future episodes, we would love to hear from you. For more in-depth coverage of these stories and more, be sure to follow us on social media at This Week Explained.
Tiana, thank you so much. And until next week, stay safe out there.
The GLP-1 pill you've been waiting for is now on Row. Yep, it's finally here. With the same clinically proven ingredient, now in a pill, and now on Row. It's the first FDA-approved GLP-1 pill for weight loss. At the lowest price available, that's one daily GLP-1 pill for big results. Now on Row. Go to row.co/listen to see if you qualify. Rx only. Go to ro.co/safety for serious side effects and boxed warning associated with GLP-1s.